why it was excluded here, and the reasoning that golf courses could better be located near or in an urban growth boundary is not reasonable because of the costs involved. If you will ask the gentleman from the National Golf Foundation, if he gets a chance to talk tonight, what it costs to construct an 18-hole golf course today, excluding the cost of the land, you'll understand why most golf courses are built on farmland, and usually it's marginal farmland or areas such as mine that are no longer economically feasible as farmland, and that's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope I do justice to your name. It looks like James Maresch.
My name is Jim Marsh. I have a commercial vineyard and orchard in the Red Hills of Dundee, about 100 acres. And I would just like to support Mr. McPherson's comments regarding the aggregate extraction section, whereby we feel that we need to tighten that section to, in effect, prioritize the extraction of rock from the, let's say, the poorer soils, allow the extraction there first, and then to proceed to the better soils. A case in point, in this rapidly growing vineyard section in the Red Hills of Dundee, a substantial amount of acreage has already been destroyed. Beautiful vineyard sites that are capable of producing an annual gross income of about $5,000 per year, probably, you know, for the next 100 years. So I just believe that the language as it is presented here would, in effect, preserve this rapidly developing vineyard industry from the exploitation, because once that pit is opened, rehabilitation reclamation project does not call for a replacement of sufficient topsoil to ever allow farming to continue. So we should be very careful as to where we extract our rock. That's basically my statement.
What kind of reclamation projects are you familiar with? Have they done an adequate job in?
No, as a matter of fact, there has been one reclamation project which has already been approved, and you're starting with a soil that's probably 10 or 12 feet deep, which has produced in the past, this farming area, which originally produced prunes, hops, cherries, filberts, walnuts, and now vineyards. The topsoil overburden is removed, and the reclamation plan calls for 1 foot of topsoil to be seeded. So in terms of a vineyard operation, it's destroyed forever. And there are beautiful slopes up in those hills that would make just fantastic vineyard sites, and they will be destroyed forever. And we're talking about substantial acreages. So I think that you should really, it just seemed to be make good sense to go after that basaltic rock in the poorer soils. And then 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 50 years from now, if we need rock at that point, of course, it's still there. It's banked. It's available under the vineyards, under the orchards. So we're really not losing the resource.
Thank you. Oh, sir, you also signed up on 234. Did you like to?
Well, my only comment there was I was under the impression that there might be I might later want to testify regarding that matter as it relates to processing of the rock extraction, but at this point I'll defer my comments.
As I said, we will be having several more hearings on this, on 237 at any rate. Bob Slauson?
Yes, my name is Bob Slauson. I'm a homeowner in Monmouth, Oregon, and represent the National Golf Foundation as a regional representative. And on short notice, I'm here to give my opposition to deleting the use of golf course as a conditional use in an EFU zoned land. Many of our current golf courses in the state of Oregon are presently located on farmland, and were originally built by farmers, you know, as a for their own use and for the use of their friends. If we exclude golf courses from EFU property or from farmland, there won't be very many golf courses built. The state of Oregon is already behind in the development of golf courses as to its population. And in Western Oregon, to build golf courses within an urban boundary guideline or and not in farmland is just the cost is prohibitive. Golf courses do provide a public.
Senator Starkey?
Bob, why is that? The person earlier, Bob Davis, said to be sure to ask you why exclusive of land costs it was.
Exclusive of land costs? It costs today between $30,000 to $60,000 a hole developing costs to build a golf course. And that the reason that the range is so wide is depending on the property and the type of golf course that's going to be built. But so land costs, and in order to feasibly build a golf course, you have to have as minimal land costs as possible, and property that isn't conducive for use as a manufacturing site or something like this. That will raise the land costs. If you get within an urban growth boundary, you've got extremely high land costs, normally. So it just almost eliminates the construction.
Well, but his comment was exclusive of land costs. It's still more expensive to build it in an urban growth boundary. I think that's...
No. My point was that...
Why don't you come up and put it on... You want to pursue this?
Yeah.
Why don't you come up... Could you come up to the witness stand again so we can put it on the record there? Sometimes the tape doesn't pick it up from the back of the room.
My point was that... The cost of, I think Bob probably has a better feel for the numbers of constructing a golf course, may be in the range of $1 million for an 18-hole course today. That's excluding land costs. And if you're looking at farmland at $2,000 an acre versus land on the edge of an urban or in an urban growth boundary at $6,000 to $9,000 an acre, it's prohibitive.
Okay, I misunderstood the exclusive. So, I thought you said exclusive of land costs.
Yes, yeah, I'm sorry. The excluding land costs.
Okay.
The fact would be, as Bob stated, it would practically eliminate the construction of golf courses if they could not be built on rural land.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
We've slipped in the state of Oregon from approximately 25,000 residents to per golf course to about 35,000 residents per golf course. The National Golf Foundation estimates that there should be somewhere around 25,000 residents per course, or there should be a course for every 25,000 residents. With this bill, there would definitely be less golf courses built, and affordable golf courses anyway. And so we would just slip further into a recreational drought of golf courses. And that's really about all. I wish I would have had more time so I could have prepared.
What the hearing notice was about a week ago, and the bill's been out since January. It's been publicly available since January, so I...
Publicly available doesn't always mean that you're aware of what's happening.
Well, I just tried to find out whether the committee made an error, or we usually try to get them out a week in advance, and we've been doing that on most bills.
Will there be probably another hearing on 234?
There will be certainly a work session on it, and if there's some other individuals that have something to contribute that hasn't been today, we'll make an opportunity for them. Yeah.
Thank you.
And you should contact our committee office if you have some additional ideas.
Thank you.
Don Coetz?
Well, I'm Don Coetz, representing the Oregon Golf Association, and we're over 15,000 members. And I, too, am ignorant of this. I just found out about it Wednesday and didn't see the bill until I got here. But I think the difficulty that they've had in getting golf course permits in the past, we've proved it's plenty tough. And I can't see any reason to delete that. Oregon State has certainly proved that it's very hard to build a golf course. I don't believe I have anything left.
Any questions for Mr. Coates? Okay. Thank you very much, sir. Michael Payette?
I'm Mike Payette. I'm a former owner of one golf course, former leaser of another, and I'm presently executive secretary of the Oregon Golf Course Owners Association. I imagine you're getting tired of hearing this, but I too am very unprepared for this hearing. I learned of it personally, I think, last Friday, and then spent most of the weekend on the telephone. I spent this noontime with two farmers, neighbors of mine from Polk County, alongside which I had run my golf course and they had run their farms. And I'm heartsick to hear Mr. McPherson identify himself as a farmer and then include golf courses as an exclusion in this bill, because in the strictest sense of the word, I spent 7 years in one location farming. And the course was established in 1926 by farmers. I have the complete records on that. It was a dairy farm. Three adjoining farmers joined their forces with monies and plows and materials and constructed that golf course. It has never, to this day, and I was out there at noontime today, caused any particular growth in the area. What growth will come because of natural attrition, not because the golf course is there. And I think historically you would find this throughout most of Oregon. The courses that are located in Portland were there because Portland was there, not because the courses were put there. I can name you three or four really, really outlying courses like Sutherland Knolls in Sutherland. That is, I think it's an incorporated area. It's not much of a spot along the road there. I know that course was constructed on federal money at that time, but in the meantime, it's individually operated now. It's paying taxes, as all of us are. There are very few municipal courses or state. There are no state-run courses in this state at this time. There are very few municipal courses. This is a microcosm, Oregon is, of individual ownership and heavily burdened tax-paying owners of golf courses. Mm-hmm. I think that the door should be left open as much as possible, even encouraged by all forces that can muster themselves to do so, to encourage golf course development, not try to thwart it, as this bill would. I would like to also write, since I am a writer by trade and not a speaker, I would like to write further conclusions to the board, if I may.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me, Senator Starkovich has a question for you.
Somebody may have said this earlier. How many acres are we talking about in a typical 18-hole golf course?
Generally speaking, it takes 60 per nine. There are a lot of nine-hole courses in the state of Oregon. My two were each nine holes. You can put 18 holes of golf within 100 acres, but it's not generally comfortable. I would say the average should be around 120 acres. And that would include clubhouse, parking, maintenance sheds, all the contiguous necessities to a golf course could be included inside of 120 acres.
Okay, thank you.
Glenn Patterson, Reverend Patterson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Glenn E. Patterson with the Seventh-day Adventist Church Northwest Headquarters, Department of Public Affairs. I have spoken to the folks in the House concerning a similar bill dealing with land uses, and they have assured me that they would be willing to bring the amendments that I am proposing here also for this, because you're dealing with similar types of things as they are over there. On Senate Bill 234, I tried to see you, Senator Kitz Harbor, the other day, but I couldn't get through to you. I went to Senator Day, And I would like to submit on page 2, line 6, following the word schools, that you replace the period with a comma and insert, including the school buildings and other buildings essential to the operation of the schools.
These the years.
Yes, they have a copy of those amendments, Mr. Patterson.
And our church currently operates 2 boarding academies in the state of Oregon and one just across the line in the state of Washington. For economic reasons, we have been considering for some time trying to consolidate these into one boarding academy rather than to operate 3 separate ones and perhaps carry on a smaller day school operation in those 2. In order to do so, we would have to centralize the area. We have one now at Milo Academy, which is way to the southern part of the state, the other one at Laurelwood in the northern part of the state. And in giving consideration to this, every time that anything is mentioned, someone say, well, with the land use program as it is now, we just can't build. We're just going to have to close the schools up. Well, now, I don't think that's a very wise plan. And so I am suggesting that this be done to insert this in there so that it will be taken care of so that they can carry on this economic program and carry on the school programs. The same thing would also be true on the other bill on page 7. On line 9, you would put in a comma after schools and then insert the same thing, including the schools, school building and other buildings essential to the operation of the schools.
Mr. Patterson.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Very basically, if we put that back to a permitted use for church schools or public schools, it would do what you want it to do instead of making it a conditional use. Is that the point you're making?
Well, the point, that's part of the point I'm making. The other point is that it doesn't appear to me that there's any provision there for a boarding school.
That's right.
With the plan that you have there, unless you have this different language.
Yes. So it's 2 points. One is a permitted use. Secondly, that we provide for boarding schools.
Right. Okay. And along with our schools, we run a farm program, which you can't very well do in an urban area.
That may be. Thank you, sir. We'll certainly, any other questions? We'll certainly consider those amendments at our work session.
Thank you.
Let's see here. Jim Allison?
Chairman, I'm Jim Allison. I live at Route 3, Box M73, Sherwood, and I'm president of the Washington County Landowners Association. During the election process last fall, there were a number of people who said, don't throw it out. We'll make some corrections or additions and improvements. I'd like to compliment former Senator Hector McPherson for his attempt to offer a number of improvements, but I'm kind of reminded of my youth. I came from a poor but honest family, and we didn't have many luxuries. When I was a wee lad, the only time I got an ice cream cone was after my mother had given me a dose of castor oil. Now, I sort of feel that in this particular instance, they're proposing to give us maybe an ice cream cone, but we're going to have to take, if this is adopted, something that doesn't appear to me to be what we had thought or hoped for. I'd like to suggest to the committee that the problem, as I see it, and I think I speak for some other people, is not drastic revisions and amendments to the code that applies to EFU. I don't think it's requiring LCDC to amend its Goal 3. My friends, the real problem is Goal 2. It's the taking of an exception. And if, in my judgment, if LCDC were to amend its Goal 2 to allow reasonable and sensible deviations from Goal 3 and not try to require virtually the entire state to be put in an EFU zone, I think you'd solve the problems. Now, the problems in this new legislation are pretty stark. First place, there are a lot of technical and issues that need to be carefully thought about and resolved. I jotted a few down. For example, if, you know, the marginal land sounds good, but the trouble of it is the definition of marginal land is such that it's not going to solve the problems of many people. Hundreds of people are not going to be solved by the marginal land, or they're not going to be in the marginal lands category. But I don't understand, if once you've been qualified as a marginal land, it is presumed that you're not going to be in an EFU zone, that you're going to, in effect, take an exception to the goals, and you're going to be in some other zone. If you're already qualified as being in a marginal lands area, then I don't know why we have to fool around with some very technical details on who gets to build a house. If it's a marginal area, let the people build a house by right, instead of coming up with this perverted version of the lot of record bit. Of course, the real jolt, and I understand that perhaps in former Senator McPherson's area and other areas, the situation is obviously different than it is in some of the hill lands of the county. But to take away from the farmer in Western Oregon the right to create a non-farm parcel is a serious, far-reaching change in the law. We've been living with that particular provision. Granted that we've had the Rutherford case and the Stevenson case in Marion County, which have in effect modified what was originally thought was going to be the law and who qualified. But we can live with the present language, and if you want to beef it up and put into the state law that which is already case law, specifically the Rutherford case, you know, I got no particular problem. But let me give you an example of what, as I interpret this new bill, is going to do. An honest-to-God, bona fide dairy farmer who lives in the Laurel area of Washington County has a son who is going to be and is assisting him in the farm operation. There were 4 acres on this 80-acre farm, on an 80-acre parcel, he farms additional land, which fit the classic category of land as described by former Senator Hector McPherson in 1973 on the floor of the Senate when he was debating Senate Bill 101, not 100, 101, about here is a piece of land that's not suitable for farming. It's never been farmed. It never will be farmed. But it might manage to take care of a house. That should be allowed. This dairy farmer has cut off 4 acres with the idea that it's going to be a house, a non-farm house, for his son, who is in fact going to be farming, assisting with the farming operation. Now, as I read this particular provision, we're saying no more non-farm houses in Western Oregon. The question arises, how about those that have been lawfully approved according to former Senator Hector McPherson's precise language and sales talk in 1973? Are we going to say, well, sorry, even though you went through the expense of getting this parcel created, haven't yet constructed the house, cannot do it? Let me point out to you that I think there is adequate protection in the law and the case law, but if you want to put the case law in, all right, to take care of making sure that honest-to-God farmland is not being used for non-farm dwellings. But to cut it off completely, let me tell you what you do. First, you take away from a farmer the right to create a non-farm parcel to give to a member of the family or sell to a member of the family to build a house. Now, the so-called Farmer Jones Amendment of 2 years ago did not solve that problem, because the only time Farmer Jones can build this house
is when he builds it on his own parcel and digs up his own financing. It's not his son's house and his daughter-in-law's house. It's his house. So I called it not the Farmer Jones Amendment, but the Mobile Home Amendment, because that was, and for all practical purposes, was the only way that could get done. In addition to taking that away, you're also going to take away from the honest-to-God farmer the right to sell a non-productive piece of land for somebody else for a non-farm dwelling. And that sale may be necessary to prevent the man from going under. I guess I should close by saying, you know, recently the Oregonian listed there was over 400,000 acres of farmland in Oregon being taken out of production on the so-called PIC program. In Washington County, we have 36,000 acres taken out. I think we've been obsessed to too large an extent with trying to so-called preserve farmland. I got no objections to preserving the honest-to-God farmland, but there is, in many EFU zones, land that is not suitable for farming. As I read the bill, you might have 15 acres of land that's zoned EFU in Washington County that has never been farmed, will never be farmed, and will never qualify for a dwelling. I urge the committee that if your intention is to try to appease those of us who have been unhappy with LCDC, that you not screw around with the EFU. That's not the problem. The problem is we need to be able to get LCDC to approve logical and sensible exceptions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Is there any questions? Thank you. Robert Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee. My name is Bob Schroeder. I'm the maintenance engineer for the Highway Division. You have, I believe, before you my proposed testimony, which actually had reference to a proposed amendment, or perhaps I should say an addition, to Senate Bill 234. With 234 now becoming 237, it puts me in a little different position and a little different location in the bill. And because of additional wordage which has been added to 237 concerning mineral aggregate sources, it also has put me in a position of, rather than just adding amendment, my legal counsel for the Highway Division says we also have another problem. If your permission, I'd like to have Mr. Jack Solis join me here for the testimony, and he can make reference to that. The proposed amendment or addition would still be appropriate in Senate Bill 237. This request has been brought about by a recent decision by the Land Use Board of Appeals. Previous to this decision, it was understood that an asphalt plant or a concrete plant was part of the processing of a mineral source. The ruling here last fall has been made that that is not the case. They refer to this actually as a manufacturing process. And then this is not permissible underneath the normal granting authority, but we'd have to go to the exception process. This, of course, can get very detailed and can be quite a problem to the counties, to the contractors, in particular. We have
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Day.
Are you coming here because of the result of the case over in Yamhill County? Is that why you're here?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, no, this was the one down in Klamath Falls.
Where's Yamhill County? They have a batch plant there too, don't they?
Yes, sir, there's batch plants all over the state.
Wasn't that at issue?
No, the The issue in Klamath Falls was when the...
I'm not talking about the issue in Klamath Falls. I'm talking about the issue over in Yamhill County.
I know nothing about that one, sir.
You know nothing about it?
No.
All right, Mr. Chairman, go ahead. Go ahead.
This proposal has the concurrence of the Association of Oregon Counties as well as the AGC. Now I think I'd let Mr. Salas address himself to the amendment that has been added in 237 that we weren't aware of until now.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Jack Salas, Chief Counsel to the Department of Transportation. A moment's explanation of the amendment proposed by the AOC and the Highway Division. The decision by LUBA indicated that although historically the counties and the Highway Division and the AGC had considered processing to include the manufacturing of asphalt and cement, that was not the interpretation they gave to the existing statute. Some of the counties